Welcome to Next Round with me, Dale McDermott.
And me, David W. Higgins.
A young Irish look at the economy, politics, and society.
Covering home and abroad.
For the thinkers, the dreamers, and the doers, this is Next Round. Hello, 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 and welcome to the latest episode of Next Round. Thanks to everyone who has listened so far. And of course, we'd love for you to give us a review and also subscribe on all available podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, etc., etc. So thank you very much. It's been a really busy time with data. And today we'd love to cover some points around wages and job data, which has been released. Also, continuing our conversation from last week, looking at Australia and Canada, and you know, the question of are there places to move to, and some challenges as well on affordability. But we'd love to start, I think, first of all, with there's been a number of reports released that talk about happiness or lack thereof for young people. David, you actually attended the launch of one today by the National Youth Council of Ireland. We'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah, so as the news dropped this morning of this report coming out, I was keen to see if they were doing a launch for it. They were. I decided to hop on a bus. I wasn't registered, but they let me in anyway. And it was a launch of a survey.
So you snuck in.
Oh, I did. Yeah. No, they allowed me to write in my name on a little sticker and put it on my a little name tag and everything. It was very makeshift. But there was a great presentation by the folks from Ipsos who carried out this poll. When opinion polls are typically done, it's usually 1,000 people of the whole population. But this was done for under 30s, so anyone aged 18 to 29. So they got a really good sample of 1,000 people just on that age cohort, and allows us to dig into a lot of really insightful topics that kind of the challenges that face young people today. So the biggest thing that came out very top towards the key findings in this was mental health, that about half of young people in that age cohort say that their mental health is low. Another 42% or so say it's okay, it's average, and then only 8% rated it as high, which was a really stark finding. Yeah, really stark finding. The report then goes into other challenges like housing, whether people perceive housing to be expensive, at what age people expect or desire that they would be able to own their first home, and the topic of life milestones. There was a whole chapter to this, and I've been harping on for a while now about what I call the milestone recession, that key life milestones that used to be more prevalent in our parents' generation, buying your first home, marriage and kids, have been pushed later in life. And I was so joyous to see a chapter on this. They actually observed that when young people were asked, people still aspire to what are described as traditional life milestones of owning a home, being married and having kids, but that they have been pushed later. And there was actually data on this where they looked at just the year. What's the typical year that you would expect to hit a certain milestone? So or that you would like to achieve it. So take buying your first home.
Was what they would like versus what they expected, right?
Yes, yeah. So the purchasing your first home with a mortgage, what you'd like to have is to do it just before you're 31. But the expectation was that it would be 32, 33. But in reality, at the census in 2 years ago, what we found was that we're still stuck at 35, 36 as being the average age. Now, of course, there's a distribution around that. There are people who were homeowners captured in the survey. So that's people under 30 who have hit home ownership. But the typical under 30 person is either renting or still living with their parents.
And I think this was the really interesting point, where I think the stat was, it was 13% of people who were 18 to 29 had actually purchased their own home. But of those, half of them got family support. So there's a real theme here, I think, around, they call it the pursuit of independence, which is, to your point, David, the the milestone recession that's happening.
Yeah, they set that out as being a key theme, which is like moving out of your family home and then purchasing your own. But they also gave a data point as well. They actually specifically asked this in the survey about people who had moved back into their family home. And they asked if people had done that in the past 2 years. I mean, Dale, in the last episode, you asked me about people from Australia, if people had ever gone to Australia, come back to Ireland, and then returned to Australia. This is a similar move where people move out of the family home and then move back in again. And then you'd imagine in a couple of years' time, we'll move into a home of their own eventually.
But I presume that's to save for a deposit, is it?
I don't think they asked for that specifically, but okay. You do hear about that, that people will do that to try and boost their savings to be able to purchase a home.
It could be a case of, you know, they might be moving back home, as many people do, to save for a deposit. Or, you know, what also came across as well was that more than half have also seen a big increase as well in the cost of their rental payments as well. So perhaps they just get pushed out of the affordability piece. I thought the living arrangements element and data was pretty interesting as well. I'll just read it out. 18 to 22 year olds, 75% of them are living at home. 23 to 26, 45% of them are living at home. And then getting up closer towards 30, 27 to 29, a quarter, 26% of them are living at home. So, I mean, that definitely has to have an effect, David, on their milestones and their aspirations and, you know, wanting to build a family, wanting to get married, et cetera, et cetera.
It does. And you're going to find that people, what seems to be happening is people don't just have an expectation that's later than what they'd like. What people's lived experience is that it's taking longer and longer to reach these milestones. And it came up in the discussion with some of the speakers at during the launch, where people said that the theme that came up was that people associate marriage and family as being very much linked to housing, that you don't really start families until you actually have home of your own. And I think there's some research from the 1950s in the US which shows that when home building really kicked up into high gear in the post-war era, that it was actually associated with higher marriage rates and birth rates. So this is where the concept of the housing theory of everything comes in, that when you build more houses and the home ownership rate can increase, it actually creates a higher marriage rate and higher birth rate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I you know, my view on this is no matter what way you try to skin this, I think everything comes back to housing, more or less. And I think I spoke with this before about, you know, we're seeing in countries that have these housing challenges, the political instability that comes as a result of that and how that infects our politics. And, you know, we have a really angry population. We have a very sad population as well from reading this report. You mentioned about half of people report low mental health. And what I also saw as well was a lack of optimism, that 3 in 4 people, when asked about their level of optimism, said that they either have optimism some of the time, rarely, or none of the time, which I think is a really depressing stat for young people who are, you know, meant to be seen as being optimistic and forward-looking and excited for the future. I didn't get that from this report, and that's not good.
Yeah, so there was a separate report that came out a couple of weeks ago, which looked at a concept called the happiness U-curve. And just to explain what that is, young people typically report high happiness. It tends to lower as you enter your 40s and 50s. Life gets tough. You're feeling pressure around your job. And then satisfaction tends to go higher into your retirement years. But some research is now showing that the U-shape no longer exists. It's now the case that some young people will be just as miserable as some middle-aged people, some people in their 40s and 50s. and there's such a wide range around all these things. There are many 40s and 50s people who are very content with their lives and don't feel stressed and pressured. But that shape in the curve has just broken down. And that's a real problem too. Dale, you mentioned about housing. Housing was listed by 2/3 of respondents as being the main issue. And I just thought it was a little funny to see some of the issues that that young people of that generation did list as being not very high, but gave some mention. 13% saying they care about taxation. 5% saying that a top issue facing the country was government debt, 4% energy supply, and 3% pensions. Now, Dale, we started this podcast of calling it Next Round because we think that there are intergenerational issues that matter, that we see ourselves as the next round. We care about the next round, the next generation coming through. Pensions, only 3% listing it as a top issue. But Dale, we're looking out for that 3% of your people. If you're a young person who listed that as being a top issue, we're your podcast. So,
and also the sad part is we are no longer able to respond to the questions in that survey because we're now out of the age bracket.
Oh gosh, yeah, we're just
30,
over.
So,
just over.
Which is on surveys, I now have to click that middle age box, which is ever more depressing. So,
Dale, I think you picked a story around the happiness theme as well.
Yeah, and just to keep going on the. The happiness report. So the happiness report is a report which has been released recently in partnership with Gallup, the Oxford Wellbeing Research Centre, and a number of other academic institutions around the world. And it validates the point which you mentioned, David, around that happiness curve, that in the West, and the interesting point here is that there's an East-West divide here. So in the West, that received wisdom that young people are happiest and their happiness declines until that middle age point, followed by a substantial recovery. Well, that's actually changed now. And it's fallen so sharply, especially in North America, to the point where the young are less happy than the old. And youth happiness has also fallen similarly in Western Europe, but not as much compared to North America. The interesting point, though, is in contrast, happiness has at every age group risen sharply in Central and Eastern Europe. So young people are now equally happy in both parts of Europe and also in the former Soviet Union and in East Asia, too. There have been significant increases in happiness at every age. So, I mean, the questions here, you know, the questions that come to mind are around, again, housing, the challenges facing that, the cost of living crisis, the pressures as a result of that. But I also wonder about wider aspects like social media, you know, the attention deployed to that, and how is that affecting Western life? It's something I reflect on, and I don't know.
I watched Katie Hannan's program Upfront last night. And the topic of, well, firstly, it was mainly about taking religion out of schools. That was the very hot debate on. But in the second half of the program, they looked at smartphones and whether children at a very young age should be allowed to have them. And they mentioned in the UK consideration being seriously given to banning smartphones for under 16s. And they did a poll in the audience, just a raise of hands at the end of the segment, and a pretty solid majority agreed with that. There was actually someone in the audience who spoke and said that you should ban, he didn't just say smartphones, this was an older guy, he said ban the internet for under 18s. Now that's harder, that's really hard because even in schools nowadays, and look, for various reasons that's impractical because many homes have a shared computer, or schools nowadays will allow kids to have a computer. But the idea of having a smartphone where you have apps that are highly addictive, that are really dopamine machines like slot machines, that are increasing rates of anxiety and depression amongst young people, that's a real growing issue. And it's now becoming a question as to whether, okay, can parents, you know, do they have the confidence to police their own children, or do we need schools and the entire country to actually step in? Because if you just take, if one parent acts and takes their phone, their kid's phone away, other kids will still have them. And then there's massive social pressure. So you really need to jump together. Either a whole school needs to say, look, we're banning the phones, or the whole country needs to say, look, we're going to implement a policy. And this is where the tech companies come in, the likes of TikTok and other ones, you know. Should we let them self-regulate, or do we really need to come down hard on policing them and fining them for allowing young people to sign up to them, where they are potentially getting shown content around self-harm, you know, making them feel depressed, even just very, very, you know, graphic and anything around beauty and comparing themselves to others and making them feel low in their self-worth, that's a major contributor, I think, to all of this as well.
But then the question is censorship going to work? You know, I mean, we've seen this in terms of hate speech, and is that the right path to go down, especially for governments around the world as they start to think about, do they legislate for hate speech and define it, etc.? Is it doable?
I mean, I think of the likes of prohibition of alcohol. You go back to the 1930s in the US where it was banned, and you had your speakeasies and ways of getting around it. Kids will find a way. Kids are tech savvy. And okay, if kids don't have a smartphone, can they then access social media from their computers? Can kids still just obtain a smartphone? I mean, if you're banning it.
Well, I think of that episode of The Simpsons with the beer baron. A phone baron.
That's it. And then you might create a black market. And in the same way that when you were in your teenage years, Dale, maybe you did this, but you might try and get someone older than you to buy alcohol. You know, kids might go around to older.
No, David, I was a saint as a kid. I don't know.
I'll ask around your year because I know a few of them.
No further comment.
That could happen, though. You really could have a black market where young kids are asking the older kids to borrow their phones or to have, you know, a hidden phone away in the house that has, you know, sneakily gotten them onto all these platforms. For various reasons, it might work. Like, you just ban everybody and then no one's there. Like, why do kids use the phones in the first place? They use it to contact others. Well, if no one else is on them, then the ban probably holds up. But there's still, lots of practical reasons why it might not work, might not be practical. But we'll see what happens.
One thing I've thought about and reflected on regarding social media and how does that affect young people's mental health. And again, the report today by the National Youth Council of Ireland, I thought was quite striking and quite depressing to read in terms of the lack of optimism and the mental health challenges facing people. But combining that with a milestone recession and social media and comparing oneself to others, you know, I think there's two things, and I'm curious at your reaction on this, David, which is around on the milestone piece. You know, if you go on social media, it's generally a positive posting arena. So you're seeing your peers and those a bit older than you getting married, having kids, getting their first home, and again, reaching those milestones. And then if you're not getting those milestones, I can only imagine the effect that's going to have on you. But then also, we use social media to look at other people. We use social media to look at celebrity. And, you know, there's now, I think, a rich cult that's been happening online where we're following people who are the uber wealthy. And if you're sitting at home in your box room, you know, looking at people with huge yachts and massive mansions all over the world, I really wonder, and I wonder if there's any research on this, how is that affecting this mental health crisis facing young people as well? Because I think probably not good.
Well, you mentioned about other, you know, people going on and seeing friends of theirs hitting life milestones, and that creates a certain amount of social pressure. But what I think the really pernicious content on these platforms is content of people you don't know, of celebrities, of people posting various beauty videos, commentary on their mental health, stuff like that, the stuff that goes viral, but is largely from people you just don't know. If people had the Facebook feeds of back to the years 2015-16, when it was just post from your friends and close circles, I think that would be a better form of social media. It's not perfect. It still allows people to compare. You're only really looking at the best bits of your friends, but at least it is something that's more real, that is closer to your own real life in-person circles. The algorithms on these platforms have really tilted away from showing you your close friends and towards showing you people that are just like really, really addictive content. That's, I think, part of the problem. On the point, though, about, you know, seeing people hit the life milestones, a piece of research I can talk about is what happens when people are mostly exposed to their peers as opposed to social media. There was a study done in the office world, right? So you're studying young people who work in an office and whether one of the peers in your office is pregnant with a child and going to have a kid. And the study looked at whether any of the people nearby in that office sitting nearby the person who was pregnant would then go on to have kids in the subsequent months and years. And what they found was if you sat closer to a colleague who was having a child, you yourself was more likely to go on and have a child in the coming years. What that tells us is that, yes, there are social pressures. Things like going on to be married and have kids is in a way a kind of a social contagion, but a very positive one. But it's one
or
that
a social influence.
Yes. But I guess the point is that it's much better to have people in your own circle being the people that you're anxious about and anxious at keeping up the Joneses on than people who are totally anonymous and far away and are creating very cultivated, perfected content that just doesn't reflect the world that you live in. That's the point I'd make there.
Fascinating. Well, it's a story which I think is going to be a theme and thematic throughout our conversations going forward, Dave. Yeah,
about some numbers now, some boring bits of data, but not boring.
Okay, fine. I knew we'd get to this point, but yes, let's talk with the numbers. Go first.
Yeah. So look, I as I said, I spend a lot of time in spreadsheets. Maybe I said that in the first two episodes, but I was really interested in the CSO and the latest earnings data that they put out. So this is wage growth, right? And wage growth gets really important when a cost of living crisis comes along. And I got a little excited midway last year when earnings growth was at around 4.5% year on year. And that's a really buoyant level. And it's one which was poised to get ahead of house price growth, right? So people's pressure on them trying to get a mortgage goes down. But we saw a slowing of that number to 2.1%, pretty much halving the rate of growth by the end of the year. And that was quite disappointing to see. But I decided to dig into the numbers and I discovered that if you look at the mix of earnings, some of your earnings are regular, your kind of your wage that you're getting, and then some of it's irregular. So things like overtime, it fluctuates. It goes, you know, sometimes you might get your overtime hours
bonuses
in a big way.
What bonuses count as that, yeah?
They do, they do. That counts. But when you actually exclude the irregular stuff and you just look at your base pay, at the middle point of last year was 4.9%, and it only slowed to 4.3%. So where I thought that the rate of growth in earnings had halved, when you look at regular earnings, it stayed high. But what that tells us is that employers are still paying significant wage increases in the Irish economy. But furthermore, it partly explains what I discussed in the previous episode about house price growth really picking up at the start of this year, 6.5% growth in the My Home survey. Well, we can actually say now that over 4% of that 6.5 is attributable to the higher wages. Because when you go to get a mortgage, the banks are going to look at your base pay, not any irregular pay. You know, when you see stories of, I saw a story of an influencer who said that they struggle to get a mortgage. If you have irregular or uncertain income, it's very hard to get a mortgage.
James Cavanaugh?
It was, he said he struggled to get a home in Dublin, and himself and his partner bought in Kilkenny. He did disclose in the article that he had a budget of around 340 or 360,000 euros. That won't get you the average home in Dublin, but it actually will get you the average home nationwide. So it seems with him and his partner, they were able to get a home. The real challenge for Ireland is actually the people who don't have aren't able to go in with a budget of just under 400k. It's people who are working minimum wage or kind of living wage jobs, even with two people, will actually struggle to get a mortgage.
Yeah. I think that's a bit more of a positive news coming from Ireland. The UK, go ahead, David.
Oh, I was just going to say, because I know you want to talk about the UK jobs data. I mean, I was just going to say that, you know, the big thing that also keeps people, keeps pressure on the mortgage market and on the house prices in Ireland is that we have full employment. And we continue to have full employment. And so long as we do, there's a lot of people out there who will have the mortgages. But Dale, you've noticed that there's a bit of a wane today in the UK's jobs data?
Well, I mean, it's never really positive news coming from the UK, but I'm going to give it again. just a slight uptick in unemployment again. It's increased to about 4.2% between December and February, the highest level it's been in 6 months. Meanwhile, as well, the rate of people with a job dipped, and also those who are what's defined as economically inactive, those who are not in work or looking for employment but are eligible, has also slightly ticked up a bit higher. So the big question now is, what does that mean for interest rates? Will there be a cut in the summer given this lower than positive data coming out from the jobs data today? But not great, I think, is the net takeaway.
There's a real risk for the UK that if they see a continued rise in unemployment, there will then be pressure, yes, on them to cut interest rates to try and stimulate the economy. The problem is that the UK runs a very wide current account deficit. And if you run a deficit, you're really reliant on the rest of the world to keep funding investments into the UK. But high interest rates attract that inward investment. And if you're going to cut your interest rates, it's kind of saying to the rest of the world, look, we're going to give you a lower return on the investment into the UK. And it might send some of that investment away. And this is how partly why we ended up with a kind of a hit to the pound during Liz Truss's time in office and Kwasi Kwarteng's time. And I know Liz Truss is plugging her book in recent days, and it's all over my feed. But, you know, the risk of a, not a blow up, but a similar kind of stalemate for the Bank of England, whereby they're damned if they do, damned they don't. If they try and cut to stimulate, they may further weaken the pound. But if they keep interest rates high, it's only going to put pressure on businesses, and then some of them may begin to let people go. It's a very tough situation. So it's hard to see a way out for the UK.
Well, and I also think the UK is in a bit of a kind of quagmire right now, right? Where, you know, they're coming to the what I think everyone agrees will be the end of the Conservative government, and almost just waiting for that change of government to happen. And I think bringing forward a bit of stability. And I think the question mark right now is, how friendly will Labour be to the business community? And, you know, Rachel Reeves, who will be the Chancellor, I think everyone agrees. A former Citibanker, knows the business community well in the UK and is well respected. But I think broadly there's caution, I think, around her and caution around Labour, given the history and the turmoil they've been over and been through over the last number of years. So I think that's probably also contributing to, I think, the investment quagmire which the UK has faced. Over the last number of years.
Yeah, if unemployment does pick up, then you'd wonder whether some of them will head off with the Irish to Australia and buttress the numbers even more going into that country. But a country like Australia...
Yeah, so you've looked at this data, David, right?
Yeah. Another one of my weekend exercises in spreadsheets. But I was really curious about the numbers going to Australia, because it's such a theme that comes up in Ireland. How many people are going? Is it an exodus from Ireland of young people? And what I found was that the numbers are way up, but they're way up because the lockdowns in Australia stopped so many people from going. Ireland is up at around, there's over 20,000 people on working holiday visas currently in Australia. And we've data on that to February of this year. It's very up to date. But while there's 20,000 Irish, there's 181,000 of all nationalities there. So there are British going, there's Germans going, French going. And I did mention I was in Australia. There was a lot of those nationalities there too. And a lot of people not just there to travel, but also to do a bit of work with the short-term visas that you can get. And Ireland's share of the total has been ticking up, but it's actually still not where it was going back to the days after the 2008 crash. You go back to 2012, Ireland had a much higher share of the visas that were there. I mean, we're over 10%. So if you come across someone with a working holiday visa in Australia, over one in ten of those people are going to be Irish. So it's not something to scoff at. But it's interesting as well. I was able to dig into the age distribution because it is very much a thing that young people do. You just typically don't find people in their late 30s and 40s going over for these working holiday visas. In fact, I couldn't find anyone above 35. There's just no data on that because there's hardly anyone.
Well, I think because one of the requirements, I think if I recall correctly, is I think you have to rotate jobs every 3 to 6 months. So you don't have that stability of building a singular career on the working holiday visa. And I think you also have to work in agriculture. So I think you have to go to a farm, if I'm not mistaken, for a period of time do your farm time.
Yeah, I'd have to check that. I don't think it applies to everyone because some of the people I met in Australia didn't have to do it for various reasons. I'd have to check what those reasons are.
I think it's a working holiday visa, though, I think. Yeah.
Okay, maybe it is.
If you go on a particular working holiday visa, to get the extension beyond a year or two, I think you have to do your agriculture time.
Okay.
If I recall correctly.
And just on the distribution, so of the 21,000 Irish who were granted a visa, this was updated to the mid of last year, over half or just about half of those people were either aged 24, 25 or 26. So it's very much a kind of mid-20s thing. It's very much just a post-college mm-hmm. thing. But as I've talked about before, we've seen just as many people coming home after doing these visas as there are going over. So whilst there's a real pickup in over 20,000 going, I expect that there'll be a return of these people as well. But if the higher number, which there is, of people in Australia transpires, it looks like we do have a net outflow of Irish people up to this year going to different countries. Now, we actually don't know what the other countries look like, but if they're unchanged and Australia really tilts the numbers, then it looks like we do have not I wouldn't call it an exodus, but certainly a higher number of people going abroad. We haven't seen numbers leaving like this since maybe 2016. So it's not the days of the post-crash era, but it's certainly a kind of a shift in the trend.
Yeah, and I recall an Irish Times article a number of years ago that looked at where did the Irish go abroad and what was the kind of net inflow or outflow as a result. And I think it said that the only country that had a net increase in Irish people, so those leaving and going to that country versus going back to Ireland, I believe what was Canada a number of years ago. I think it might have been 3 or 4 years ago. So I'll actually dig out that article and find out. But okay, you know, we spoke about this, David, before. Why are people going to these countries? And certainly, just on my own reflection, you know, from having lived abroad in one of those countries, I know that you know the issues around quality of life. So the ability to live out on your own, alone, in your 20s is an achievable thing to do. The ability to have a wage that commands the ability to do that and to live your life and not straddle yourself with the inability to have any sort of disposable income to then spend and live in those cities is another reason as well. But we spoke about the whole idea of while house prices in Australia and Canada and other countries may not be affordable, they're certainly more attainable. And they're attainable, and I know you referenced debt slave, that yes, you can get a mortgage for, you know, a home for a one bed or a two bed for $1 million. And yes, you can attain it, but is it really affordable? I know Canada just last week, they increased their maximum amortization period for mortgages for first-time buyers from their standard 25% now up to 30%. And again, I think that's a policy to address or at least keep that attainability factor for first-time buyers. But right, I think that's just some reflections I'd give.
Yeah, so the debt slave trend is you're going to be a debt slave for 5 years longer.
And 5 years longer, yeah. And if you think you live longer, so
yeah. And if you think about how getting your first home can be very much a 30s thing, if not a mid 30s thing, then you add 30 years on top of that. You're talking about paying off your mortgage. If you don't, you might get a second mortgage, but at least your first mortgage, not paying it off until your 60s. And that's around about the time that people like to top up their pensions and get a bit more into the pot before they retire. So you're ending up with a very narrow window to do that. Whereas you hear stories amongst generation before us, Dale, who were able to pay off their mortgage maybe in their 50s, they would have gotten the first home at an earlier age, didn't have the long amortization. They have the space to build up their pensions and then retire comfortably. Our generation, when it comes to it, are going to get really squeezed on this. And then at a time when we probably need people to pay even more into their pensions because people live longer, the longer life expectancy. It's a problem we can't solve. It's a problem we can only solve by people either working longer, more affordable housing. There's just no easy way out. And yeah, unfortunately. I shouldn't end on a bad note, should I, Dale? Have you a good note to end on?
I have a reaction more so than a positive, but we are seeing things in like a reverse equity mortgage and that product now starting to come to life where people who are later on in their life own their home eventually and then, you know, selling some of the equity back to banks to then keep cash, to then top up their pension and spend. And that's obviously going to be very bad for those inheriting that property, their kids, going forward. But that is, we are starting to see some of those forward-thinking products now starting to reach into the market as well.
That's a good point. And actually, I had a conversation, a brilliant conversation with a friend today. We were just talking about investing from a young age, right? You know, nest eggs from birth, right? And this friend, he was telling me about the US, where a lot of some work is going into starting basically an account from when you're born that has, let's say, €1,000 of shares in it that gets reinvested by, let's say, the NTMA or some management agency. And then you either get that to buy your first home, or you can keep building it up, let the state keep building it up in shares until you retire. So that could really help with the pensions issue. The only problem is we'd be starting that for the generation that we'd be given birth to, Dale, and then that builds up over time. So our generation wouldn't avail of that, but it is something
So what I'm hearing, David, is once again, our generation gets the short end of the stick. Is that right?
Yeah, I was just going to say it's something for the next round. I was just giving the podcast a plug because...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we have to do that a bit. So, yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Well, on that somewhat unhappy note, somewhat not unhappy note, I think we can leave it there, David. We've covered a lot and looking forward to our next conversation.
All right. Good stuff, Dale. Thanks.